KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
The low in the low 50s.
It's still a hugely meaningful story in its many, many versions to millions of people all over the world, not only as a religious text, but as a cultural text, and as a way of looking at the contemporary world.
Hey, do I believe that independents will win this campaign? Yes, I do. And I believe we'll win it by setting out a positive vision for a better future for our country, both economically and crucially also socially.
The number of lemurs on this biennial list has increased steadily, and it's now up to 6. And this is basically reflecting the very difficult situation in Madagascar at the moment.
Today on Weekday, we're going to talk about the Ramayana, Kurt Beatty talking about that work with Marcy Silman. Alex Salmond is the leader of the Scottish Nationalist Party. We're going to talk about the move towards Scotland's independence. And the number of lemurs on the endangered list is increasing. The number of primates on the endangered list increasing. Our cousins dropping off the planet. I wonder why. That's all something we're taking up today on the program. But we start with our own backyard. Yesterday, Seattle City Attorney Peter Holmes, council members Sally J. Clark, Bruce Harrell, Tim Burgess, Nick Licata released a joint statement. In it, they questioned Mayor Mike McGinn for his criticism of Merrick Bobb, who was under consideration for Seattle Police Department monitor. Steve Miletich is a reporter for the Seattle Times. He's covering this issue. Steve Miletich, thanks for talking to us again.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Now, first of all, let's get our timeline straight, if we may. Mayor McGinn released his criticism of Merrick Bobb in a press release a couple days ago.
He actually made the comments in public yesterday during a news briefing. The briefing was about jobs, but at the end of the briefing, he talked about the monitor situation and his objections to Merrick Bobb as the monitor.
You've been covering this story for, well, all along, but you've been tracking it a few days. Was that a surprise, that criticism?
Well, we had reported 2 days ago that this criticism was brewing. We attributed it to sources, and what happened yesterday is the mayor came out publicly and confirmed that he objected to Merrick Bobb as the independent monitor for the Seattle Police on the grounds that Mr. Bobb has a conflict of interest, that being that a person on the board of Mr. Bobb's Los Angeles consulting firm helped write the Department of Justice report that found deficiencies in the Seattle Police Department.
In your reporting on this issue more broadly, does that conflict of interest appear among other? This is a very limited population of people who work on Seattle Police Police Department reforms. So, does that conflict of interest appear in Philadelphia, in New Orleans, in other places where there's been this sort of oversight?
You know, it's hard to tell because there is so much overlap, and these people do move in the same circles. I have heard that this is an issue that comes up with various candidates and monitors. We're still trying to sort that out. I think the city is still trying to sort that out. It's something that could come into play with other candidates.
Now, then after the criticism of Mr. Bobb, we have the Seattle City Council releasing. This seems fairly unprecedented, this press release. They are sticking to their guns, and they are questioning the mayor on this. Is it unprecedented from your reporting on city and city council?
I haven't seen anything quite like this. I think what you're seeing are some long, simmering tensions over this issue finally exploding into public and exploding at a time when we're at a crucial point in the reform effort.
Unfortunately, the mayor's statements today contribute confusion, doubt, and mistrust, especially among our rank-and-file police officers who we believe are fully ready to embrace high-quality and professional improvements of the Seattle Police Department. That's what part of what was in that joint statement. Tear that back a little bit for me. What are you reading in there in terms of the power and the positions that are being jockeyed about?
Well, I think Mr. Holmes and the council are saying that the mayor is undermining the process by calling into question the integrity of the monitor candidate, Mr. Bobb. and that they feel that this is part of an ongoing pattern of conduct on the mayor's part that has damaged the reform effort.
Who is the who's the mayor's? Do we know who the mayor prefers for this position at this point?
The mayor has said he's open to any one of the finalists other than Mr. Bob, and that would be Michael Giannacco, who's the watchdog of the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department, Michael Bromwich, who's been a monitor of police in Washington, D.C., and Jeff Schlanger, who helped with the monitor situation down in Los Angeles when that police department came under scrutiny. He has said that he understands that the Department of Justice has some qualms with Mr. Giannacco, who's come under fire in Los Angeles for supposedly being too close to the sheriff's department. So the mayor has said he's open to dropping a candidate, but among the those remaining, he hasn't singled out any one of them. He did note that Mr. Bromwich appeared on both the federal list and the mayor's list of finalists and suggested that that might be a way of resolving this.
Steve Miletich is a reporter for the Seattle Times, along with Mike Carter. They've been tracking what's been happening in the back and forth between the mayor and the city council over the quest for a monitor who has to be appointed and in place to work on the consent decree oversight of reforming the Seattle Police Department. When does that monitor have to be in place?
Well, they have to submit a choice by next Friday, a week from Friday, October 26th. It can either be a joint recommendation, a single name that they agree on. If they can't agree, they will each submit lists to the federal judge who's presiding over the consent decree and let the judge decide. So basically we're looking at a little over a week for them to come up with an answer to this.
This is, as you mentioned, a small population of people who have either already been monitors under other consent decrees or people that are close enough to warrant attention from the various parties. But have there been, how much of an outsider has been chosen before? Have you looked at the people who have been chosen as monitors in other municipalities?
Well, generally it's people with experience. This whole Department of Justice process of reviewing police departments and imposing these consent decrees goes back a number of years. So in that time, a certain cottage industry has sprung up of people who do this because it does require a certain amount of knowledge and having a team in place, a staff, and being equipped to do it. It's not just something somebody can jump into and do just because they have some basic qualifications in law enforcement or police accountability. It takes an understanding of how these things work. And so there's a ramp. They usually look for people who can ramp up pretty quickly and know their way around the drill.
Well, Mayor McGinn has an advisor in Connie Rice. We've heard what he says about Mr. Bob. We've heard what the council has to say about his reaction to it. I guess the next thing is we're going to hear the mayor, and we'll find out what other police officers who can't speak will have to say about this. Do we know from this joint statement by the council that Merrick Bob was the council's first choice?
I don't know if the entire council, but the four council members who issued the statement and Mr. Holmes made it clear that Merrick Bob is their first choice and they will push for him. And so we're now looking at a situation where there will be looks like there'll be a split within the city unless somebody changes their mind. As we go forward, and then also we'll have to see how that fits into what the federal recommendation is. So there's a number of balls in the air.
Yeah, and of course, we're seeing it negotiated in public, which is an interesting place for us all to be. I guess transparency is what we get, and transparency is what people wanted. Steve Miletich, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Steve Miletich is a Seattle Times staff reporter. He is covering the story of the city attorney, council members, and Mayor McGinn in opposite sides as they move towards appointing a monitor to oversee reforms in the Seattle Police Department. This is Weekday.
Good morning. It's 9:15. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle. I'm Andy Hurst. Last year, the Washington State Supreme Court told lawmakers to fully fund basic K-12 education. State Superintendent Randy Dorn says that'll cost taxpayers an additional $4.1 billion per year. He's running unopposed for re-election this year. Randy Dorn joins us later today to talk about his goals and vision for the next 4 years. He sits down with KUOW's David Hyde this afternoon at 12:20.
Support for KUOW comes from the Master Builders Association Remodeled Homes Tour, featuring 21 projects throughout King and Snohomish counties. Remodelers for each project will be on site to answer questions. More information at remodeltour.com.
We have clouds and a little bit of sunshine in Seattle, 51 degrees in the University District. Forecast calls for clouds and a chance of rain later today, the high reaching 63. Clouds and rain tonight, the low in the low 50s. Cloudy again tomorrow with a chance of rain. Tomorrow's high in the mid-50s.
Scottish independence is moving to a vote in 2014. Monday, Britain's Prime Minister David Cameron and Scottish First Minister Alex Salmond signed the Edinburgh Agreement. Voters will be asked one question, whether Scotland should leave the United Kingdom. James Cook is Scotland correspondent, BBC News. Thank you for talking to us.
Yes, a pleasure.
The Scottish National Party began its annual conference today. How did Mr. Salmond open the conference?
That's right. Well, Alex Salmond opened the conference in very good form, in very good mood, and cheering on his delegates, really, to enthuse them to come together and try to ensure that in 2 years' time they get as many people voting as possible. And he opened that conference in Perth, which is a small step in the centre of Scotland from where the old kings of Scotland used to be crowned at Scone. So it has some historical resonance where he's talking as well. And the SNP do hope to tap into some history when it comes to the vote in a couple of years' time.
Now, I looked at a report on a new poll that was out just today, and it said support for Scottish independence continues to drop. Is that the sense you're getting in Scotland as well, that independence high among maybe folks who are living in the most economically deprived regions, but in the urban areas, not so much support?
Yeah, and to be honest, not a majority of support in either of those two socioeconomic groups. The polls have not been good for some years, really, for the Scottish National Party. They've never really shown a support for independence, for Scottish independence getting above 40% consistently, certainly not above half. And usually they've just maintained a fairly stable position at about a third of the electorate. So the SNP clearly have a lot of work to do. The opponents of the Scottish National Party, those who want to keep the United Kingdom together, are fairly cheered, I think, by the recent polls. But I think they're not complacent either, because they know that, you know, they say a week's a long time in politics, which is a terrible cliche, but 2 years is an aeon.
And yet the Scottish National Party was put into office saying they would finally get the referendum on the ballot. Why was that?
That's right. But it's interesting when the pollsters quiz the population more specifically on why they voted for the Scottish National Party, who first came into power in the devolved administration in Edinburgh. Scotland has a devolved administration which looks after various home affairs such as, for example, health and education and law and order and so on, but doesn't look after foreign affairs, defence and macroeconomic policy, which is still dealt with by the Westminster government in London. And when people are asked why the SNP got into power, first as a minority government in 2007, and then in the next election as a majority government, people say that they were impressed by the economic competence of the Scottish National Party, that they were impressed by their plans to run Scotland in this devolved context. But what's interesting is not all of the people who voted for them, when they're asked, say that they were prepared to vote for independence, although, as you suggest, they knew that this was on the manifesto, they knew that an independence ballot would come along, but Alex Salmond, the leader of the Scottish National Party, was very, very careful in the last election campaign to point out that the two things were separate. He said, you can vote for me and my party, even if you don't believe in independence, because you will get another chance to make up your mind on that separately.
James Cook is Scotland correspondent, BBC News. The vote is 2 years away. The Scottish Parliament gets to manage the vote. Why was it important, I guess for both sides in the end, to have one question on the ballot?
Yeah, this was an interesting debate about what exactly Scots were going to be asked. The polls also suggest, and there's some support for this among politicians, that the public are interested in a position that is further than the devolved administration they have at the moment, i.e. the devolution of more powers to the Scottish Parliament. So, for example, more tax-varying powers, more ability to raise their own taxes and decide in more detail exactly how they'll be spent, but that they were shying away people from full independence. Now, this position came to be known as Devolution Max or Devo Max. It was never particularly well defined as to precisely what it would mean, but Alex Salmond said that he was interested in consulting the people as to whether this should be an option on the ballot paper. Some people suspected that he wanted it as an option, as a fallback option, as a safety net, because with the polls suggesting he might lose, that at least he would gain significant more powers for the Scottish Parliament, and then perhaps the debate would move forward, and in coming years Scotland might be able to take that final leap to independence. But for both sides, I think, particularly for the Conservative administration of David Cameron, the British Prime Minister in London, he was very keen that there should just be one straightforward question. He was keen that, in his words, that the outcome of this vote must be decisive and must be fair. And so he basically got his way on that, although it's a matter of interpretation, because Mr. Salmond is now essentially saying, I didn't really want this all along, and I'm quite happy with what's happened now. But in any case, this argument has gone by the board. We may return to it after the vote, I suppose, in a couple of years' time. But for now, all the focus is on that simple, straightforward question. Although what exactly the question's going to be, Steve, we don't know for sure yet.
Oh, is that right? It may have some nuance to it?
Yeah, I mean, a question has been proposed by the SNP, and as you rightly say, that the matter is now in the hands of the Scottish Parliament. What Westminster has done, it held the legal authority to hold referendums in the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. It has temporarily transferred that authority for this poll only to the Scottish Parliament. So the Scottish Parliament will now decide when the poll takes place. We believe it'll be autumn 2014, what the question will be and who will be enfranchised to vote. There's a suggestion that the voting age will be lowered so that 16 and 17-year-olds can take part. But as for the question, Alex Salmond has published a question, which is, do you agree that Scotland should be an independent country? Various people have looked at that and have suggested that perhaps you could argue that is slightly leading, that perhaps do you agree or disagree would be a fairer way to phrase that question. And it now goes to a body, this question, if indeed that's the precise question that he continues to stick with, in whatever that question is, will go to a body called the Electoral Commission, a non-partisan public body which will examine it, will test it, will take it to various experts and focus groups, and then will report back to the Scottish Government and say, we think this is fair, or perhaps we suggest a slight tweak for an alternative.
You know, James Cook, Simon Sharma, the historian, said, what began as a hostile merger ended in full partnership in the most powerful going concern in the world. He was talking about what became known as the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland, and then it became known in 1927, the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. So that's Scotland, that's Wales, that's Northern Ireland, it's Britain. What happens to the UK if Scotland becomes an independent country?
Well, this is one of the many, many unanswered questions about what precisely would happen if Scotland became an independent nation. As you say, that union was forged, first of all, between Scotland and England with acts of both of their individual and then sovereign parliaments in 1707. That was when the union of the parliaments took place, although the two nations, incidentally, had been united under one monarchy for perhaps just over 100 years, since 1603. And interestingly, Alex Salmond proposes that one of the things that wouldn't happen is that that would not change, basically. He says that he intends to keep the House of Windsor as the monarchy. So Queen Elizabeth II, if she is still on the throne in 2 years' time, or indeed a few years beyond that, by the time the whole issue was settled, if Scotland votes for independence, would remain, and her successors, as the monarch of an independent Scotland. But what would happen to that rest of the UK, as it's being termed here in the newspapers, RUK, a particularly kind of unattractive phrase, is not really exactly clear. For example, people are saying, will Scotland have to reapply for membership of the European Union, for the sake of argument? What would be its position with regard to NATO? But given that Scotland and England formed originally two nations, came together to form one nation, some people have suggested it wouldn't just be Scotland which would have to reapply for membership of the European Union, that perhaps the rest of the country would also have to apply, because this essentially, by the actions of the Scots, would form a completely separate and new state, which would have to be considered in a new light by the rest of the world as well. But of course, we're a long way from that as well at the moment, a long, long way away.
No, as you say, we're 2 years of intense political campaigning. I guess it would be a Commonwealth model like Canada. They would still have the Queen come over and do things.
Yeah, I think that's the idea. That's exactly the idea. And Alex Salmond has been clever, because over the past decade, really, he has watered down his vision of what precisely independence would mean to try to win over people who were perhaps scared off by a more radical version. So, for example, not only would Scotland, under the Scottish National Party, I mean, we're assuming they would be in power in an independent Scotland. Of course, they might not be. There would be a democratic election and another party might take a different view. But were the SNP in power, that they say that they would also keep the pound sterling, the previous position had been to join the euro. But as your listeners will understand, the euro is not exactly in the best shape at the moment, and it's not regarded as a stable currency to join. So the Scottish National Party has moved towards embracing the pound again. That has led to allegations that Scotland would not be in control of its own interest rates and would essentially have to enter into a monetary union with the rest of the United Kingdom, leading people, some people who are opposing the change, to ask, well, what's the point? If these fundamental things are not going to change, why bother at all, some people are asking.
And the answer from the Scottish National Party is, we'll have our own flag? What do they say?
Their answer is, I think at the very heart of the activist gathering for their party conference this end of this week and into the weekend, for many of them, the answer is very simple. It is more in the heart than anything else. It is that they simply believe that Scotland was and Scotland should be again an independent state. And it's just as simple as that, that the last 300 years have been an anomaly and that it should revert to what is, in their view, the correct and obvious position. But obviously, that argument alone is not going to win the campaign, and they know that. So they go into more detail by saying that what is important is that if Scotland became independent, it would have much more detailed control over its own affairs. It could formulate economic policy in a way, they argue, more suited to Scotland than, for example, to the more prosperous southeast of England. And they argue that Scotland would generally be better off being able to make its own decisions on all matters by itself at a parliament based in Edinburgh rather than by a relatively distant parliament in London.
James Cook, I appreciate you talking to us.
It's a pleasure. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you. James Cook is Scotland correspondent, BBC News. Scottish voters will go to the poll on the question of independence in 2014. This is Weekday. Now the fate of our cousins on this planet. A list of the 25 most endangered primates comes out every 2 years. Released this week, the list includes seven species that are new to it. Katie Sewell's tracking it.
Researchers from the International Union for Conservation and Nature found that more than half of all the primates are at risk of becoming extinct in the world.
Yikes.
Because of human activity. So I called up Christoph Schweitzer this morning. He's the head of research for the Bristol Conservation and Science Foundation, and he was involved in putting the list together.
This whole list of the top 25 most endangered primates is a tool, a media tool, to essentially get the world's media and public interested in the plight of primates. So it's a good tool to raise people's attention to what primates are suffering in the wild.
And why limit the number to 25?
That's a good question. We thought 10 would be too few because then it would be really difficult to make a choice. And anything more than 25 would just be too many to arouse media interest. So we came up with the number 25 so that we can have a few from each primate habitat region that we highlight. And it's just a manageable number as well.
And can you explain what criteria is used to decide which primates end up on the list?
Yes. So all of these primates on the list are either endangered or critically endangered on the IUCN Red List, which means that they are very close to extinction. And then we look at the threats that these primates are under at the moment and the likelihood of them going extinct in the very near future. And then the rest is basically discussion among experts. So we always come up with these lists at the biannual meeting of the International Primatological Society, where about 600-700 experts meet to discuss all things about primatology. We usually have a session there of several hours where all of these experts contribute, and then it's a consensus in the end of the ones that are deemed the most at risk of extinction.
Well, in looking over the list, there seem to be a lot of lemurs on the list. Why is that? What's going on with them?
Yes, that's right. The number of lemurs on this biannual list has increased steadily, and it's now up to 6. And this is basically reflecting the very difficult situation in Madagascar at the moment. You may know that Madagascar has seen a political coup, an illegal power grab in 2009, which has led to a political crisis that is ongoing since more than 3 years now. And the political crisis has very soon led to a full-blown environmental crisis as well. The government was dependent on bilateral and multilateral aid. This has all been frozen or disbanded completely. So the government has run out of money to pay civil servants for things like forest protection and so on. There's essentially no law enforcement, no environmental law enforcement at all at the moment, and that has led to an upsurge in illegal activities such as logging, lemur hunting, and so on. So lemurs are now hunted almost to the same extent as primates in continental Africa, where the bushmeat trade is well known. We haven't seen that before in Madagascar, but we are now increasingly seeing that to the same extent, really. And especially on the east coast, in the eastern rainforests, illegal logging activities have increased dramatically to the extent that many of the previously rather well-protected national parks are being logged for tropical hardwoods that are exported mainly to Asia, mainly to China, actually. And lemurs are suffering a lot from that because they're losing their habitat and they are being hunted out of these forests.
I'm speaking with Christoph Schweitzer, who's the head of research at the Bristol Conservation and Science Foundation, who is involved with the study that put together the list of the 25 most endangered primates. So I noticed on the list of threats, one thing that keeps coming up again and again is also the exotic pet trade. What's going on there?
Yeah, that's right. This is especially a problem in Asia and Southeast Asia, for instance, with lorises. Lorises are small nocturnal primates. And these animals are really hunted by the hundreds out of the forest to be then sold on markets in Indonesia in particular, but also some other countries, to people who just want to keep them, who fancy keeping a primate for fun. You may have seen or you may be aware of various videos that have appeared on YouTube where people tickle lorises and do all sorts of things with them. These videos on the first glance appear quite cute, but when you really look into it, this is against all animal welfare policies. These animals are really frightened. You can see that when you observe them. Yeah, this is really increasing, and many of these animals are being sold on these markets to local people, not so much to international buyers, but mainly to local buyers. With the lorises, these animals have very sharp teeth and are also the only venomous primates. So the traders on the markets cut their teeth out very cruelly, actually. And then what happens, even if they are rescued and brought into rescue centers, they can't be released back into the wild because without teeth they would immediately die in the wild. So you can't really bring them back either. It's a very difficult situation there.
Is there one primate that you yourself are particularly worried about?
Well, there's one that I have been working with myself since almost a decade now, which is the blue-eyed black lemur in northwestern Madagascar, which is also part of the list since about 6 years, and I'm very worried about them because their habitat is disappearing as we speak. So up until 2008, I would have said these animals weren't doing greatly, but at least I could see some light at the end of the tunnel. We've been active in a conservation program for them since many years now. We've been working with the local communities surrounding the protected area where they where these animals come from, and it was actually going rather well. But then once the political situation had changed, it all went pear-shaped, and now we are really seeing these forests disappear at such high pace that we are struggling to even do anything about it. So these animals are under severe threat, and these are one of the most beautiful primate species that I have seen so far, and I would really like to be able to show them to my children as well when they are old enough to go to Madagascar, and I don't want to say to them, unfortunately, I couldn't do anything about it, and you can't see these guys anymore in the wild.
Mm-hmm. One of the hard parts about a list like this is that when we hear about it, it's so depressing, and you feel like there's not much that you can do. Is there something that people can actually do to help?
It's not all depressing. So first of all, there are some success stories which are due to ongoing and intensive conservation efforts, mainly. Sorry, one second. I need to tell my daughter off because she's coming in here, and we need to do that again.
Martha,
geh mal bitte weg. Ich mache hier gerade. Ich arbeite, okay? Ich komme gleich zu dir und lese dir weiter vor. Ja, du musst den Papa noch 5 Minuten in Ruhe lassen, okay? I've just asked her to be quiet. she is very keen on me reading a book to her. It's not all bad news. It's not all so frustrating because, for example, there are some species that we were able to take off the list. One example would be the greater bamboo lemur, which occurs in eastern Madagascar. And this species has seen such a lot of attention in the last couple of years, mainly due to it constantly being on the top 25 most endangered primate list, that researchers have found a lot more of these animals where we thought previously that there were only 2 or 3 groups left in one particular national park. We now know that there are at least 400, probably more individuals left in the wild. The distribution range is much larger than we had previously thought, and this species is now off the list because of that. So there are some success stories, and what people can do, well, it's essentially a big funding question. So we need a lot more money going into primate conservation in the next couple of years to actually be able to cope with all these challenges. Donations would, of course, be always very welcome. And then raising awareness, if parents can tell their children, if teachers can tell their pupils about what these primates are going through, and so on. And that would also be very, very welcome, so that we have a new generation of primatologists potentially coming up, helping us with these challenges.
Christoph Schweitzer is head of research at the Bristol Conservation and Science Foundation. He was involved in putting together the list of the 25 most endangered primates. If you want to see the list, you can find it at our website, kow.org. Thanks so much for joining us, Christoph.
No problem at all. Thank you for interviewing me.
Venomous primates. Maybe they do have a response if we keep bothering them. This is Weekday.
We have a mix of clouds and sunshine in Seattle, 53 degrees right now in the University District. We're expecting clouds the rest of this afternoon with a chance of showers, the high reaching 63. Clouds and showers expected tonight, the low in the low 50s.
Support for KUOW comes from UW School of Public Health, joining Public Health Seattle and King County with the message that water and skim milk are healthier choices than sugary drinks.
Secret political donations are a big thing in the election campaign this year. It makes some people nervous, but why?
Keeping a secret can and often does violate expectations for honest communication in a relationship.
I'm Kai Rizdal. A look at secret money, the latest in our special collaboration with Frontline. That's next time on Marketplace from APM.
That story and much more coming up tonight at 6:30.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Opera, presenting Beethoven's Fidelio. Compassion trumps tyranny in Beethoven's only opera. Fidelio runs October 13th through the 27th at McCaw Hall. Details at seattleopera.org.
Now another edition of The Art of Our City. The Ramayana is an ancient Sanskrit epic, in verse, about ideal relationships between fathers, servants, wives, and kings. ACT Theater opens its world premiere adaptation of the Ramayana tonight. The play was adapted by two playwrights, Yusef Elgwindi and Stephanie Tim, directed by Sheila Daniels, and ACT artistic director Kurt Beattie. The idea for the project was Beattie's. It's the first production by something ACT is calling Affiliate Artists Working Group. It's a collaborative of performing artists from many media. Marcy Silman visited Kurt Beattie to find out when he first decided to tackle this project.
About 2 years ago, I thought this would be an amazing thing to undertake.
Why?
A huge variety of reasons. For one, it's a new story to a lot of Americans. Secondly, when you expose yourself to it, you realize that it is a great epic tale and that it's a foundational text in world literature. Thirdly, it's still a hugely meaningful story in its many, many versions to millions of people all over the world, not only as a religious text, but as a cultural text and as a way of looking at the contemporary world.
Let's take several centuries steps back in time. I went online trying to find any kind of pithy synopsis of the story, and I failed. So maybe you have devised one.
Yes. In essence, it's a story about a very good man and his very good wife who is abducted by a very bad man. And it's the job of the very good man, the hero, to rescue her from the clutches of this very bad man. Rama is the good man and his good wife is Sita. And Ravana is the demon king who abducts her. It's a little bit, it has resonances like that of Troy.
in reading all the synopses, because I have to say I have not read the original text of the Ramayana, you're thinking of all those great Greek epic tales of people journeying and rescuing and battling. It's the, sort of the same.
It has a lot of the same elements, a lot of the same elements. The Ramayana, though, has been, or Ramayana, it depends on where you come from in Asia, has so many different interpretations and means very different things, I think, in Hindu culture and in the other cultures in which it's an important story.
This tome that's sitting on your coffee table here is this gigantic, beautiful cloth-bound edition, which I think is in the original. Is it Sanskrit? Is that what it's in?
The first literary version of this tale is in Sanskrit, yes.
And I'm assuming that the two playwrights that you chose to adapt it were working from an English translation, but it's huge. It's verse. It's there are, as you mentioned, there's multiple layers. We're talking about gods, and there's jealousy, and there's kingdoms. So in talking with the two writers who had to delve into this, were there directives on your part in terms of the path that they should follow to make their way through this?
Not explicitly. The tale is so vast that what we thought we would do is we wouldn't inhibit ourselves. We wouldn't tell ourselves that we wanted to say anything with it, that we wanted to reflect it, but inevitably reflect it through our Western sensibilities. That said, we took great pains to find out what this story may mean to many, many people who are not Americans.
And in fact, there's a whole religious element to this story because, as I understand it, Rama is the avatar of a god and Sita is the avatar of a goddess. And there's that spiritual layer as well as the sort of heroic epic journey.
Yes, bhakti in India, which is devotional. He's a devotional focus, as is Sita, as is Hanuman, as is even Ravana in some places. All societies have to create for themselves moral understanding. The great struggle of all human civilization is human behavior. What we need humans to be and what they actually are. Not gods. And Rama, in this context, is a description of right action, of dharma, of goodness, of love, of those intuitive values that we all can recognize without understanding the giant moral systems that all our societies have created for us in order to enact these moral values.
How much did you know about this prior to 2 years ago?
I was initiated to it, as many people were, in the West by Peter Brook's production of the Mahabharata, which was, I think, a fantastic achievement. And then, because I, like many Westerners, study yoga, asana yoga, which is, you know, the physical practice of yoga, I, through my wonderful teacher, Joe Leffingwell, I began to discover the Yoga Sutras and the vast achievement and history of Asian culture, and particularly South Asian culture, particularly Indian culture. And through that, I began to discover new things for myself and new history and how it reflects on us today and in this ever-increasingly closer world where Indian civilization is becoming American civilization is becoming Indian civilization, where everybody is moving towards each other. Particularly, I think this is a natural outgrowth of being an American because, as is often noted, and I hate to cite the cliche, but I believe it, we are a nation of immigrants. We are constantly renewing ourselves with new imagination, new energies, new perspectives. And certainly, the presence of Asian thought, Asian ideas, and people of Asian origin in this country is greater and greater in the moment. So it seemed to me a natural thing and a good thing for us to grapple with this.
Kurt Beattie talking to Marcy Silman about the opening of the Ramayana, which is opening tonight at ACT Theater. It runs through November. Now a look at the media itself. The Seattle Times has taken out ads for in support of Republican gubernatorial candidate Rob McKenna, and will take out ads as well in support of gay marriage. It's launching a $75,000 independent expenditure campaign promoting those issues. That raises questions about the firewall, about news, about how we will view the news that comes out of the Times. It's a question that newspapers, public radio stations, all media grapple with. We thought we'd ask Roy Peter Clark, who's vice president and senior scholar with the Poynter Institute, about this issue of the newspaper taking out these ads. I asked him if it was an unprecedented act.
It sort of stands out as remarkable.
The newspaper is being remarkable because they are trying to divide advertising, editorial, and news in a way that might be confusing to some readers, yes?
Well, you know, I think that's true. And I think, you know, let's start with, let's stipulate that many people believe that news is, the news that they receive is biased. And I think that claim is grossly exaggerated, you know, for ideological reasons. If the newspaper report something that feels unfavorable to you or that you object to or contradicts your worldview, yes, you may see it as biased. So there have always been ways of protecting both readers and purveyors of news from those kinds of accusations. And one is to sort of, we used to call them walls. There used to be a wall between news and advertising. There used to be a wall between news and the editorial page. And in the last 20 years, certainly, because of many different kinds of social, technological changes, economic changes in particular, some of those walls have come crumbling down like the Berlin Wall. You know, I think the Seattle Times deserves its reputation as one of the best newspapers in America. And I work with a lot of the journalists there and know they operate with a tremendous amount of integrity. It's difficult for the reporters who are covering the gubernatorial elections or who are covering issues such as gay marriage to have to go out into the world and be fair, dispassionate, even-handed, nonpartisan, disinterested in the face of the fact that the newspaper is running house ads on the business side in support of a particular political point of view. This happened to me way back when I was starting in journalism, and the newspaper I was working for, the corporate side, had donated money to a lobby that was opposing casino gambling. And I was one of the reporters assigned to cover a ballot initiative in favor of casino gambling. And when I talked to the pro-casino folks, they said, why should we talk to you? You're not going to be fair to us. And I said, what do you mean? They said, well, your newspaper has given $25,000 to oppose this. And I said, well, that's the business side. But I think to any reasonable person, the appearance of conflict can be as powerful as the conflict itself.
That's been the standard in a lot of other industries, isn't it? Including politicians.
No doubt. You know, and look, the antidote to conflict of interest is sort of full disclosure. But boy, when the newspaper takes out a house ad in support of something, that's tough. Now, listen. On the other hand, while I can't defend this, I understand the importance of the business side of the news organization being more enterprising than they have in the past, looking more aggressively for streams of revenue that will support the news resources that the newspaper needs. All boats sink on a low tide, and we all know that this has affected the news industry tremendously. And so it must be frustrating for the print people to look at the millions and millions of dollars that their broadcast brethren rake in during the election cycle for political advertisements. So I think that's part of what's going on as well.
Roy Peter Clark is Vice President, Senior Scholar with the Poynter Institute. All right, last quick question here. How is this different from when a public station, public media station, takes an underwriter from a corporation or a nonprofit and then still has to cover that nonprofit? Or, I guess, when a newspaper takes ads from a campaign and still covers that campaign? Where's the line that's been crossed? And are those three separate things, or is one closer to what we're talking about here?
Well, I think public radio has had a problem for a long time with underwriting. And I think that public radio has attempted over time to sort of establish a set of standards and practices that says that just because someone underwrites a project of reporting, it doesn't mean those underwriters control the message. But I think that what we all hope for is that conflicts like these will be minimized and will be managed, but no one can deny that it makes it harder on the rank-and-file reporters and editors. Those are the ones who go out there and who bear the brunt of accusations of conflict and other things.
That's Roy Peter Clark. He's Vice President, Senior Scholar with the Poynter Institute. That's a journalism think tank. It's based in Florida, talking about the Seattle Times decision to take out ads to show the effectiveness of newspaper advertising by showing their support for Rob McKenna and for the same-sex marriage initiative.
And now, the sound of the day.
That's the sound of 35 ukuleles, learning a strumming pattern, their players are learning that, at the monthly song circle of the Seattle Ukulele Players Association. I like that. That's John Leader. He's the Seattle Ukulele Players Association president, sent that sound into us. Make that strum work, people. Ukulele. I know I'm supposed to say ukulele, but there you are. What's the interesting sound you're hearing? Are you taking ukulele lessons at the Seattle Ukulele Players Association or ukulele? Or are you taking lessons in something else? Or is there some interesting machine that you work around that you think we should hear? We were talking yesterday about printing presses and printing. And I was remembering that I worked for a little newspaper in Eugene, Oregon, and we had to carry the dummy copy over to the place in the basement, I believe, of the Eugene Register Guard back in the early 70s when they were still using, you know, I think it was the Guard, they were still using old printing presses where you had to set in the linotype, set in the type, rather. So I would like to hear that sound again. I don't know if they exist. I think most of them are just, most printing presses or printing shops are much more electronic and mechanical than mechanical. But maybe you work for a shop that has some old machine that's working its way into our museums, but still in use right now. So maybe old machines, maybe something else that just piques your interest. We'd like you to share the sounds that you are hearing to help us understand what the sound of this world is like these days and your world as well. If you record 30 seconds of a sound and send it to us, just the way over the electronic email, weekday@kuow.org, put sound of the day in the subject line. We can play your sound, the sound of your world. Remember to get that microphone as close as you can to the machine, because it sounds so much better. Dow Constantine is joining us in a few moments. We'll talk with him about what's happening in the county. We're also going to talk with Sarah Dickerman about a lunch recommendation. And Katie Sewell, she's going to deviate a little bit from her old-time radio. She wants to think about old-time television. She wants to know what happened to all those people who were the voice actors for It's the Great Pumpkin, Charlie Brown. So that's all coming up. Stay with us.
Good morning. It's a minute before 10. Headlines from NPR News, less than 2 minutes away. Stay tuned.
Support for KUOW comes from Pacific Medical Centers, providing same-day...
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.